Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Do you ever have those moments where you feel like you're being watched? But you might look over your shoulder and then check again. You might be feeling a bit uncomfortable, a bit panicked because this feeling's so strong. Or you might have a weird sixth sense about a presence in the room with you as you drift off to sleep. Or you might wake suddenly with a terrifying sensation that something is pushing down on your chest and yet no one or nothing is there, but you can't shake the feeling. Now, in psychology, this experience is known as the felt presence. And joining us to explain more is Dr. Ben Alderson-Day. He's from Durham University's Department of Psychology. He's the author of a new book called Presence, The Strange Science and True Stories of the Unseen Other. Hello, Ben. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi there. Good evening.
Now, this is a fascinating instance where mind and body sort of come together. It's also described with the more familiar term of a sixth sense. What might people be experiencing if they have a case of sensing a felt presence?
Well, it is kind of like the things you've been describing in terms of feeling like somebody might be watching you or just a really eerie feeling that someone's in the room. But in truth, this is the kind of experience that a lot of people might recognize, and yet they find it really hard to put into words because there's this very basic feeling, almost this gut feeling, but it can be really hard for people to explain, well, how or on what basis do they say that somebody else is in the room? It's not like they can see anybody. It's not like they can hear anybody. They've just got this feeling almost in their bones, and that's why it gets called a felt presence. But it's interesting you mentioned the sixth sense there. I mean, in truth, we think the scientific basis of this feeling lies in our body's ability to sense things beyond the traditional five senses. And there's nothing spooky about that, but it does speak to the different ways in which our perception works.
So you've basically sort of figured out, Ben, that you're more likely to have an experience like this if you're going through something particular in your life. What are the kind of range of situations in which people might more commonly experience this?
Some of the most famous are in survival situations or endurance situations, often if people are on their own, really pushed to their limits, both mentally and physically. So a really well-known one is called the third man effect or third man syndrome. And explorers, mountaineers get this often when they're kind of almost at the point of death, of the bit of the mission where if they don't manage to do it, they're not going to get home. Suddenly they feel like a figure is with them, almost like a guardian angel. And we call it the third man because it goes back to Ernest Shackleton's experiences in 1916 when he was trying to save the endurance expedition. He had to cross the interior of South Georgia Island, just him and two other men. And they actually felt like there was a fourth companion with them. Now, the way history works, the numbers get confused and we end up calling it a third man. But essentially, there's this idea of a companion who's there with you through adversity. But these presences can also happen closer to home. People often experience them in bereavement. People can experience them as part of clinical disorders, neurological disorders like Parkinson's. Even some people experience them nightly through things like sleep paralysis.
So just going back to the Shackleton expedition, so what, there were three of them and it was sort of the fourth man that got turned into the third. Did all three of them experience the same feeling?
Reportedly they did. Now, they were quite reticent to say much about it, but two of the three men, Shackleton and Frank Worsley, who was a Kiwi, they both described this feeling of this other figure with them when they were doing this trek. Tom Cream was an Irish sailor, and he barely ever spoke about it afterwards. Reportedly, he spoke to some friends once and said the Lord had saved us. And often people come to spiritual explanations for what's happening, but it really is an unusual and remarkable case that because it happens to all three of them at the same time.
Yeah, extraordinary. And they're able to sort of, I guess, back each other up. And so it's quite common for mountaineers and adventurers in extreme situations then.
Yeah, yeah. And some of that is just purely to do with the conditions. So high altitude climbers, particularly if they go over, say, 6,000 feet, they start to experience things like hypoxia, where the brain is basically starved of oxygen. And you will start hallucinating many things in that context, particularly things like visual hallucinations. People who do like free diving or caving, the kind of sensory deprivation that's involved in those, and sometimes with diving, lack of oxygen as well, those can cause very basic hallucinations too. But it's almost like there's one layer of kind of just straightforward hallucinations, and there's another layer of these weird kind of companions that sometimes appear, like I say, without any sight or sound. And so they pose a real challenge to scientists to understand, but they also create sometimes the most meaning for the people who experience them.
And so some people also report hearing voices, don't they?
They do, they do. And indeed, you know, hearing voices is perhaps one of the most common forms of hallucination. 5 to 15% of adults sometime in their life will have an experience of a voice that other people can't hear. And then the most common type of hallucination in conditions like schizophrenia as well. With presences, it's a little bit more around the edge. So it might be a voice that just comes once, and then you have this eerie feeling of presence that just lingers and continues for a long time. But these things are all kind of slightly connected. And often it's in a way, whether it's the slight hint of a shadow or a vague sense of a voice, and then this lingering presence, it's that feeling that you're joined by another, by an identity, a kind of social being.
Ben, have you ever experienced this yourself? I'm just sort of wondering how your research has ended up heading in this direction.
In truth, no. I'm an incredibly boring man, and I'm the world's worst hallucination expert, because nothing has ever happened to me in this way. I mean, I've talked to, you know, psychics, I've talked to psychonauts, you know, people taking ayahuasca, all this sort of stuff. I've talked to people with clinical disorders about a whole range of weird experiences, but me myself, I've never experienced them.
You've talked to psychics as part of your research.
Yeah. I mean, psychics end up in scientific research more than you might think, not least because if you talk to people who work as mediums or psychics, they might feel like they have a strong sense of their capabilities right now and might use them in their professional practice, whatever you think about, you know, the objective basis of that. But if you talk to them about their life history, you know, they might have many years where they were actually having quite uncontrolled, unusual experiences from a very young age that don't always necessarily fit into what we'd call, say, a spiritualist framework. That also means that they sometimes end up in research where you try and compare people who have like hallucinatory experiences and find them really distressing. So people who end up with like psychosis or schizophrenia. And then you compare that with people who sometimes have regular unusual experiences, but don't find them distressing or don't really need to use mental health services. Sometimes they get called non-clinical voice hearers, which is a really clunky term, but it gives you a sense of what they're like. And it's those latter group people who end up sometimes becoming psychics, becoming mediums, as if they've been experiencing the world in a different way all along. So scientists find this group pretty interesting, you know, in a way when we're not trying to test their abilities in any way, but we are interested in what kind of things they can see, what kind of things they can hear, because it might tell us something about really the variety and heterogeneity of how the mind works.
So you're sort of saying that if you're climbing a mountain and you get to over 6,000 metres and you start to be deprived of oxygen, then there's a kind of clear reasoning. You can go, okay, something's happening in the brain, which is causing, you know, the hallucinations or whatever it is. But what do you think's going on for other people who are having this sense of felt presence?
Well, let's come back to that idea of a sixth sense. We're used to the idea of the five senses, right? And it seems clear to us when, if we're having an unusual experience involving one of those five senses, we can try and describe what's happening. But our bodies draw upon other kinds of sensory information, such as proprioception, knowing kind of roughly where our bodies are in space. If I shut my eyes and I reach my hand out, I have a rough sense of where my finger is in space, because essentially the feedback from our muscles tells our brain what's happening. Now, that sort of sensory process can be disrupted. There's various different kind of illusions that you can create in a laboratory to give people the sense that maybe a limb doesn't belong to them or a new rubber hand does, and all this sort of thing. Largely, what that relies upon is the way the brain combines lots of different sensory cues to give you a sense of your own self. And often that depends on simple things like timing and synchrony. Imagine going to clap your hands. When you're getting ready to clap your hands, your brain is expecting a simultaneous sound, a simultaneous vision of the hands coming together, and touch-based feedback when those hands come together. Now imagine if you did it, you went to clap your hands, but you heard the sound just before you saw your hands touch. What would you think? You'd think that A, something is weird going on, and B, maybe somebody else made the sound. And it's as simple as that to really disrupt our own sense of what belongs to us versus what belongs to somebody else. Now, when it comes to presence, what might actually be happening is we're disrupting some of those proprioceptive cues, those bodily cues about where our bodies should be in space. And we know, say, from kind of case studies in neurology and neuropsychology, that when you disrupt that, sometimes people can get kind of mirror figures, shadow figures, people like the sense of a presence mirroring their own body posture. So really what we're doing there is we're creating a hallucination, but out of our own bodily sense, a kind of true sixth sense.
I'm just astounded thinking about this. You know, something I always think about, Ben, should say I'm talking to Dr. Ben Alderson Day. He's an associate professor of psychology at Durham University and author of Presence, The Strange Science and True Stories of the Unseen Other. Just talking about this idea of the sixth sense. Time, for example, you can go to sleep and you can wake up again and somehow you can sort of figure out what the time is, even though I always think there's no way you should know what the time is, because you're taking in other sensory cues, aren't you, than the obvious ones.
That's right. That's right. And people's own judgments of time can often feel very, it's almost kind of a bit of a black box. You have a vague sense of it, but you can't really explain how or why, on what basis you've judged time. But people, you know, people study the psychology of time, particularly people who are interested in things like music perception, music psychology, how drummers keep time, how brilliant musicians are excellent at kind of tracking time. And in truth, you know, we have to rely on lots of different cues to give us a kind of sense of time. If you have to, you know, if I asked you now to try and estimate a minute or 2 minutes, you might try and count in your head, but other people can do things like track their own heartbeats. They can get a sense of time based on their own body clocks. In a way, we have lots of different information we can draw upon. It's just we're not always particularly consciously aware of how we do it.
Can you try to recreate in any kind of way in the lab these experiences so that you can get a better handle on what might be happening in people's brains, or is that just impossible?
Oh, you can. You can. And there's a long history in research on hallucinations of trying to induce these kinds of experiences or create tasks which are kind of an analog, kind of similar to the kind of experiences people are having. Perhaps the most successful for presences was a procedure developed by a team in Geneva led by a neurologist called Olaf Blanke. And they had something what I call the presence robot. Now imagine if you're sat on a bar stool and you've got to shut your eyes and you've got to kind of poke your finger into thin air as if you're basically really drunk and you're trying to remember what your PIN code is, something like that. And you just kind of keep on pressing and pressing. Now imagine doing that and your hand is in a kind of glove, which is attached to a computer system. And then tracking those movements, there is a machine that then tells a robot to touch you on your back at exactly the same points as you're pushing out into thin air. So you touch left and you get touched on the top left of your back. You go down and right and you get touched on down and right. Now, as this procedure goes on, as long as it's in sync, after a while, you'll start to have a really weird feeling like you're touching your own back. And the reason that happens is the brain takes all the cues together, relying on the timing, and it goes, look, the only explanation here is every time I'm touching, I'm getting this touch on my back, it must be me touching my own back. Now, if you train the brain to start thinking that, and then suddenly you start to disrupt it, you slow down the touches, you make it drag, you make it slightly asynchronous. Some people get a really weird feeling. They suddenly get a jolt. They feel like somebody's there behind them, because by disrupting the timing, you've broken that link for the self, and suddenly it becomes a question of other, not self. So when you try this in the lab, a large proportion of people start to get these felt presence experiences. Some people suddenly look behind them. Some people start laughing or kind of jolt. People with Parkinson's disease, who are particularly susceptible to felt presences, are really susceptible to this effect with the presence robot in the lab. So what we're doing there is we're disrupting the body's own cues of where it should be in space, where we expect touches to be, where we expect our muscles to be. And that's how we create something that looks like the hallucination.
So what's going on with Parkinson's sufferers that means they're more susceptible to this?
Well, this is something that I think people are still trying to get their head around and really only just understanding the extent of it. There are some studies which estimate that 25 to 50% of people with Parkinson's might be having frequent presence experiences. And I think that the key there is that there's so much disrupted in terms of movement in Parkinson's as a result of the changes to dopamine levels in the brain. You get things like tremors, you get things like problems of coordination of movement. And so what's happening is that's changing the brain's own map of where the body should be in space. So that likely underlies one aspect of why you'd have these kind of bodily hallucinations happening. On the other hand, we know through changes in the brain in Parkinson's that things like visual hallucinations become much more common, particularly if it turns into a Parkinsonian dementia. And things like dementia in Lewy bodies, which is another Parkinsonian disorder, involves lots of hallucinations, and they're often much more visual than, say, in schizophrenia or something like that. And that's largely, we think about how the brain networks are changing in response to the course of the disease, and it's particularly seems to be affecting visual areas and areas in relation to attention. So in the one sense, we've got changes to body and movement in Parkinson's, which might provide one cause. And on the other hand, we've got some general changes happening in the course of the disease, which might make certain types of hallucinations more likely anyway. Won't necessarily happen for everybody with that diagnosis, but there are some hints that actually it happens to a large proportion.
If people do find them very distressing, is there anything that you can do about it?
Well, I think the first thing you can do is put a name to it. Lots of people I've spoken to, the thing that they find most unsettling is that they can't describe it. They've never heard of it. And they think that they're the only person it's ever happened to. I spoke to one guy with psychosis who had been hearing voices for many years and was used to talking about that in the clinic. And it was only maybe the third time that I interviewed him that we started talking about presences. And he said, you know what, I don't even try to describe this in the clinic because I think it makes me sound the most weird. You know, I'm very happy to talk about lots of other stuff that perhaps other people would find strange. But presences seem to really hit at the limits of what seemed possible. So on the one hand, I think some people just find it a bit easy to manage if they know that this is a thing that can happen and can affect lots of people in lots of different ways. I think we're still working out, you know, what would be the best therapeutic options for people who are having this experience and finding them distressing. And some of that might rely on, you know, understanding more about the causes of this experience. It seems like some people are more susceptible to this than others. And some researchers have speculated that if you've had lots of adversity in your life or trauma, you know, essentially threats to your body, then it might be that that would make you more susceptible to presences too. Now, we need more evidence to test that link. But if that was the case, then obviously we start to think about kind of types of therapy that might be more along the lines of, you know, treatments for PTSD, this sort of thing. So there's lots of research needs to be done there. And I wouldn't want to speculate too much. But certainly, I think the first step is just to acknowledge that it's a thing and it can happen to lots and lots of people.
Dr. Ben Alderson-Day is with you on Nightlife, Associate Professor of Psychology at Durham University. His book is Presence, The Strange Science and True Stories of the Unseen Other. Now, bereavement is something else that can often cause this to happen. Now, I'm particularly intrigued by this because when my mother died suddenly when I was 18, I remember waking up one morning with this huge crushing sensation on my chest and the feeling that someone, I assumed it was my mother, was sitting there on the bed with me. And yet I thought, well, it can't be. Could this have been an example of something like this playing out?
Absolutely. On the one hand, bereavement presences are seemingly the most common kind of experience people have if they have a kind of continued experience, say, of a loved one of somebody that they've lost and they're grieving for. They seem to be more common than, say, voices or visions. They're often, you know, they can be quite comforting. They might be quite recurrent, particularly for people who've experienced, you know, lost, say, a life partner. They're not always wanted, and they're not always, you know, of people that people would want to have a continuing experience of, if that makes sense. But they do seem quite common, although it's hard to study because often people don't really want to talk about that too much. But intersecting with that, lots of people will have presence experiences around the boundaries of sleep, particularly in cases where they wake up And then they feel like they can't really move much, a phenomenon known as sleep paralysis. But they might also have that sense of pushing down on their chest, a kind of crushing on their chest. Part of the reason that happens is that our muscles are slightly paralyzed in the shallower stages of sleep in the early morning that's associated with REM sleep. And that also includes changes to the muscles controlling our breathing in our chest. And we're not usually, aware of that. So people get this kind of sense of a pushing. And then they also get the sense of a presence. Now, often those presences are malevolent in sleep context, but they can be the presences of bereavement too. And they can be, comforting and welcome, and often just very transitory. They might only happen once. That is perhaps one of the most common examples of presence that people experience.
I'm imagining a lot of, lots of people have a ghost story or two. A lot of those stories could probably be explained by felt presence, couldn't they?
I think they could. I mean, I think it's interesting. A lot of people assume that's what you mean when you start talking about presences. They think this is a story about ghosts, and it could shed some light on why people would describe kind of certain types of ghostly experiences. I think one slight difference which might be important is that often feelings of presence seem somehow tied to us or tethered to us. It's us waking up in that particular situation in sleep, or it's us trying to, get to the top of the mountain or something like that, and the presence is usually kind of alongside us or not too far away. It's not so much about going into a particular situation that makes you feel that, going into an eerie room or something, which is often ghost stories always seem to be very much about, atmosphere and our feelings of a particular place. Presences seem to say something about us, and indeed they do seem to be tied to us, and like I say, the ways in which our brains are tracking our sense of self. And so there's subtle differences there, I think, and between what seems to be kind of the paranormal versus what's unusual, but actually kind of everyday and part of our human experience.
Yeah, I'm just thinking there've been so many stories you hear, like, I felt a presence, I really felt like somebody else was there. So do personal feelings and beliefs also play a role in experiencing the felt presence?
I think they do for many people. So I particularly thinking of, psychics that I've spoken to or people from spiritual communities we've surveyed, often if they're having these experiences, they don't, while they might be unusual, they have a very clear idea of where they think they come from and what they signify in terms of having a spiritual basis. Other people won't necessarily have a kind of a belief context for these experiences, and sometimes that can be the most startling. You do get, particularly with the endurance and survival presences, you get lots of people recounting being joined by a companion that's very significant to them, might be spiritually significant, might be somebody who's significant in terms of their life or biography. So that sense of kind of emotion and belief shaping what's happening seems to be really key. But presences can also be really surprising. They don't always necessarily cohere with what we believe is possible. And so it's not always a kind of straightforward line between what people are expecting or what people think is going to be the case and what happens. It's a bit like, if you open yourself up to these sorts of experiences, or you put yourself in a situation, say through adversity or stress, where these experiences happen, then you don't necessarily get to choose who steps through that door. It could be something kind of very startling and very strange.
Wow. My mind's been blown by learning all this tonight. Ben, thank you so much for joining us and explaining felt presence to us on Nightlife tonight.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Ben Alderson-Day, Associate Professor of Psychology at Durham University and the author of Presence, The Strange Science and True Stories of the Unseen Other.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.